when I was a child, like I was always wanting to go into mental health. My father had like bipolar with psychosis, a lot of suicide attempts. So I always wanted to go into mental health, but not work with children. And then they kept putting me in internships and practicums with kids accidentally. And I fell in love with kids. And so went into child therapy, but not with a specific focus on anxiety or OCD. And then started to really find a passion in helping kids with anxiety and OCD in particular. So it was kind of a windy journey because then I wrote a book and the publisher wanted me to have a platform and I didn't know what that meant in 2015. Yeah. And so I'm like, okay, I'll create one.
Yeah.
I'm like, what is that? Yeah. I thought you were going to just market my book. That's not how it works. And I fell in love with the online world. And so fast forward, I've just created, you know, online resources for parents who are raising kids with anxiety and OCD, and eventually close my private practice and focus full time on just building this global community of support.
Welcome to Parenting Teens Today with Jesse LeBeau.
Well, everyone, I am so excited for you to meet Natasha Daniels, and she has been doing amazing work helping parents for a long time. She has books, she has communities, she has an awesome YouTube channel with a ton of resources. So we are going to dive into it today. And I want to just, you know, let you kind of take some of the lead here with some of the things that are on your heart and on your mind and the things that you're seeing that are going on. But before we jump into all that, I would love to know, how did this all get started for you? Did you plan that this was what you would be doing at this stage in your life?
No, you know, and I think that's why, you know, plans are kind of a universal joke because you don't know, it's a windy road. You don't know how you're going to get from A to B. And so I've stopped making plans, like without the flexibility of knowing that that's just a thought, you know, it's an anchor point. I may not get over there. When I was a child, like I was always wanting to go into mental health. My father had like bipolar with psychosis, a lot of suicide attempts. So I always wanted to go into mental health, but not work with children. And then they kept putting me in internships and practicums with kids accidentally. And I fell in love with kids. And so went into child therapy, but not with a specific focus on anxiety or OCD. And then started to really find a passion in helping kids with anxiety and OCD in particular. So it was kind of a windy journey because then I wrote a book and the publisher wanted me to have a platform and I didn't know what that meant in 2015. Yeah. And so I'm like, okay, I'll create one.
Yeah.
I'm like, what is that? Yeah. I thought you were going to just market my book. That's not how it works. And I fell in love with the online world. And so fast forward, I've just created, you know, online resources for parents who are raising kids with anxiety and OCD, and eventually close my private practice and focus full time on just building this global community of support.
Amazing. And how long has it been going on? How long have you been doing all this?
Since 2015, like right out of the gate, but it's grown. You know, it's 2019. I opened up an online community. I think maybe 2016 or 17, I had online courses. YouTube kind of came later. I think I had a podcast first. I always, like, I'm forgetting the order of things, like slowly evolved.
Yeah. I love it. So the parents that come to you for your support and resources and community, is it mostly kids that are struggling with anxiety and OCD, or is it other things as well?
No, it's completely anxiety and OCD. It's very focused. That in and of itself is a huge topic. So
yeah, I feel like we all know when it comes to anxiety, how it has just gone off the deep end and so many kids are struggling in that area, but I don't always hear about OCD. It's almost like that kind of gets not enough attention, or it doesn't have as big of a marketing team behind it. How did you get so passionate about helping kids that are struggling with OCD?
Yeah, and it's frustrating because I think there's a huge amount of people that struggle with OCD. It's just, it doesn't get diagnosed or identified, even with the people that are suffering from it, because you're right, it's just not out there. The education piece needs to be out there more.
Yeah.
I don't know how it happened. I mean, I have three kids with anxiety and OCD, but that happened after I got interested in focusing on anxiety and OCD. I have some relatives with OCD, but I think out of all the things I was treating when I was in my private practice, OCD was the most rewarding because it was the therapy was very instructional and task oriented and skill building and solution focused. And I saw results really fast, and I loved the tangible element of, I'm going to teach you this. I'm going to normalize this. And I'm going to teach you how to like take these brave steps systematically. And it was satisfying. It was like seeing people in like complete chaos, and then all of a sudden seeing them progress was just really rewarding.
How quick of a turnaround are we talking that you're seeing those kind of results manifest themselves?
Every kid's different, but a lot of times it is even just normalizing it and saying, you know what, there's something called moral OCD, and you have intrusive thoughts about being a bad person, and that's a common OCD theme, and you're not alone. Even that is therapeutic. Just knowing, oh my gosh, I'm not crazy. There's a name for this. There's a theme for this. There's treatment for this. That moves the dial 50% in just identifying it. But every kid's different as far as how long they've been dealing with OCD and how open they are to trying the tools, how willing the parents are to pull back their kind of entanglement with OCD. But some kids can make progress really quick. And so that's just amazing to see.
Yeah. Do you feel like most parents are aware that their kid has OCD, or does it go undiagnosed a lot of times?
It definitely goes undiagnosed. The International OCD Foundation often talks about how it can take an average of 17 years to get diagnosed and find proper treatment for OCD, which is crazy. So you're talking about six, seven therapists in before someone says, you know what, I think this is OCD. And then they'll refer out because they're like, a good therapist who actually doesn't have extra training in OCD will recognize that that's out of their scope and refer them. But then there aren't enough qualified OCD therapists to treat, especially for, you know, pediatric OCD. That's even harder.
If I'm a parent who's listening to this right now and I'm wondering, well, I don't know, does my kid or kids have OCD? What are some like steps or things that they can be looking out for to be more aware of this possibly being something that their kid is struggling with?
Yeah, I think a lot of times we think of OCD as being a neat freak or obsessively washing your hands or lining things up. You know, we think of, you know, I'm so OCD. And we really think of that's what OCD is about. But OCD could be anything. It's an intrusive thought or feeling and the need to do or avoid something to get that brief relief. Those are the compulsions. And so it's a two-parter. It's the obsession, I'm having intrusive thoughts, which a lot of us do, but we filter them out. You know, I might be walking down the stairs and I think, oh, wouldn't that be funny if I tripped and I cracked my head open? That was disturbing. And then it's gone, you know? Or, you know, there's a knife. Wouldn't that be weird if I like just took it and stabbed my kids? Whoa, that was a really awkward, weird thought. And it's gone. You know, we have really upsetting, intrusive thoughts. Every human being has them. But when you have OCD, they're not filtered out. They're more frequent. And you get stuck on it. You get stuck on the content of it. And then the compulsion is, whoa, why did I have that thought? Or why do I have that feeling? And I say feeling because you can even have, you hyper-focus on your breathing, or you hyper-focus on your blinking, or you hyper-focus on your bladder, and you're disturbed by it. So it's this stuckness, which can look different for each person, and then the need to do something to get that brief relief. So if I'm stuck on, you know, my heart beating or my eye blinking, I might just over blink, or I might just, you know, look in the mirror and make sure, am I blinking still? Or am I breathing still? And so as parents, they might notice some irregular or odd behavior, some nonsensical conversations. They're conversations that almost feel like they're in a loop. You're like, why is my child asking me this again and again? You know, I thought in my head that you were fat. Is that a bad thing? You know, and the mom's like, well, no, we all have thoughts. That's okay. And then it's a loop, you know. And yesterday, I'm pretty sure that maybe I tripped my friend, you know. And the other day, I think I, you know, and now there's all these confessions of I think I might have. That normally the parent will start to feel like, why are we having these circular conversations and we're processing it or we're problem solving it and we're getting nowhere? Those are some early signs.
So if a parent sees some of these signs, what are like a couple of the best steps that they could take to maybe get a second opinion or a professional help with these things that they're noticing?
Yeah, I always tell parents, educate yourself, because unfortunately the mental health world is not educated on OCD.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know why. They don't teach it typically in graduate programs. You know, they'll touch on it very briefly, you know, going through the DSM, but it's very rare for a graduate program to even dive deep into OCD and its assessment and its treatment and presentation. And so as parents, if it runs in your family, because there's a highly genetic component to it, or if you have that gut feeling that you're like, something's off. I always tell parents, first, educate yourself. There's plenty of videos and I have a podcast. There's books. There's education out there. And then get an assessment. It cannot hurt to get an assessment. But you want to get an assessment by someone who actually treats OCD. So I often tell people to go to the International OCD Foundation. They have a directory at iocdf.org/find-help. And that's a great place to start, just to see if you can get an assessment.
Okay. And as they're educating themselves, what are some of the best tips and practices that you encourage parents to do, whether it's on your podcast or in person in your practice? What are some of the things that are good first beginning steps to combat a kid that's struggling?
OCD kind of hooks you in as a family. I call it a family affair more than even anxiety, because the compulsion will involve the parent almost always. And so as a parent, it's really intuitive to like want to help your child. And so if they want you to say words a certain way, or they want you to wipe things down before they can touch them, or they have these nonsensical rules and you know that they don't make sense, but it gives your child some brief relief, it's very, very hard to not do that. And it's very hard to see why not doing that is actually helpful for your child. But when you are completing that OCD loop, you're really growing those neural pathways that grow OCD bigger physiologically. And so as a parent, I would say educate yourself about OCD first, educate your child about OCD. And there are tools out there that are very accessible, and then slowly pull back your involvement with the OCD, which will feel unnatural.
So don't give it more attention, because it can become a thing where, oh, this is something now that I'm getting attention from mom and dad because they're always having to come and talk to me about this thing. Is that kind of the thought process behind that? Or is it because they need to learn how to manage it on their own, or maybe a combination of the two?
Something a little bit different. So if you think of like the circuitry of the brain, it's stuck, you know, so OCD is happening in the basal ganglia and the circuitry going into the frontal orbital cortex. And so it's stuck, it's getting stuck. And the way that it unstucks, it gets unstuck is through compulsions. And so if I feel like my hands are dirty, we'll just use something kind of stereotypical. If I feel like my hands are dirty, I go wash my hands, I get brief relief, and OCD says, okay, we're unstuck. And instead, the way to actually outdo or outsmart OCD is to not wash your hands, sit in the discomfort, and ride the wave. And when you ride the wave, you don't scratch the itch, it goes away. And over time, the OCD gets smaller, because you're not hitting the escape clause. You're not doing the compulsion. You're not washing your hands. Parents are the metaphorical sink. And so sometimes the question is an OCD question. It's not your child asking. And so a child might say, you need to respond to me and say, like, you have to say it in this way, you know, and they'll say, no, mom, you have to say it in this way. You have to say it, you know, and they'll get very anxious about it. When you do that, or let's say your child wants you to wipe things down or touch something for them because it's contaminated. And when you do that, you're basically doing the compulsion. You're the sink, if that makes sense. And so the ultimate goal with OCD is to teach kids, and I actually think it's a life skill for any person, but it's to teach kids and human beings to sit with discomfort. You know, I can tolerate this discomfort. It's resilience. It's like, I'm having this intrusive thought, but I don't have to do anything about it. I'm having this intrusive feeling. I don't have to do anything to get relief. I can ride this wave, sit with this discomfort, and get on with the things that matter to me. And that's really the ultimate goal.
Yeah. I could see that being tough for a lot of parents because you want your kid to be happy. You don't want them to be like uncomfortable with a situation or out of their comfort zone, but it's almost like you're enabling them. If you're like, okay, like, because once they get out into the world, people aren't going to say sentences the way that they want to, or necessarily be the cleanliness in how they want it to be. So that makes a lot of sense. Do you see OCD is always a negative thing when it shows up in people?
I do, because it's a brain disorder. It's a brain disorder. They can show this in MRIs where the brain is like literally overheating in the frontal cortex. And so it's a glitch in the brain, but luckily there is no neuroplasticity and we can behaviorally do things that actually alter our brain, which I think is incredible and amazing. So it's not like other neurodivergent aspects of people where it's like, it's part of who you are and it's embracing your differences. The more you do the compulsions, the more disabling OCD becomes. And a lot of people are completely disabled from OCD. They are unable to go to work. They're unable to go to school. They become housebound. They are living in a back bedroom. Like they can't touch anything. It can really grow pretty quickly out of control. And so there are positive aspects of the personality of people who have OCD tendencies. And I think it's important to highlight that with kids, because we want to salvage the positive things with kids with anxiety or OCD. And so I always tell people who have OCD, there is a commonality between people with OCD. Yes, there's this glitch in the brain, but also they are out of the box thinkers. They're incredibly creative. They notice details that other people don't notice. Those things, high intelligence, you know, off the charts sometimes. And so those qualities are awesome. And they kind of come with the package a lot of times with OCD. And so I think focusing on the good attributes while tackling the disorder is really helpful.
Yeah, definitely. Because I was just thinking even at my own life, as my hands were touching the stand while we were talking before we started recording, I'm like straightening it out, making sure it's perfect. I for sure have a certain level of OCD. I wash my hands a lot. I don't touch door handles. And that's just the stereotypical ones. But in some areas of my life, I know that's actually been an advantage because like I won't leave a basketball gym until I make 10 free throws in a row. And the last one has to be a swish. And that's part of this OCD, perfectionism, everything. But I don't have it controlling my life so that I'm not able to do things. And that is exactly what you said earlier, where I know sometimes I overdo it on having everything have it to be clean and neat and tidy and perfect. So sometimes I force myself to not wash my hands, or I force myself in exercising. I like have to push it that last 5 minutes. I have to push it really hard and get to a certain level. And now the challenge for me is stop. Because everything in my identity and in my perception of who I am is like, you're the person who goes extra hard and doesn't quit. And so I'll actually force myself to do the thing. And it's more uncomfortable to stop early or do something shorter than it actually is to go for that whole time. So it's like, if you can find a way to manage it, it can almost become like a little bit of a superpower. But that's why I was just curious if you ever see someone who has this OCD, but they are able to, like you said, maybe lean into creativity or lean into like a higher level of intelligence. Not saying that's the situation that's going on over here, but that is interesting to see that you kind of do see that in some cases. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, definitely. And it seems like intuitively you are catching, maybe even subconsciously, the hooks of OCD. So then you as a go-getter are like, I'm going to actually stop this and cut it short because that's going to be more challenging than actually finishing, versus some people where they would get stuck on the whoosh and they would be there for maybe 5-6 hours and then the whoosh happens and it didn't sound right. So they have to keep doing it until it feels just right. Then you get into like some major dysfunction, but you're intuitively recognizing, okay, this is swinging too far. I'm going to auto correct. That's good.
A little bit. Yeah. Yeah. If not, you don't have control over your own life and that stuff. I mean, same thing. Like, yeah. I'll go back and did I shut the garage? Like, I don't know. And I'll go back and it's like, yeah. Dang it. How could I not remember? I was just there, but I don't want to take a chance of doing that or leaving the door unlocked. But it helps now with the phone having apps that tell you that, okay, it's been locked for 3 minutes. We're good. The garage is closed. Do you see a correlation with kids with OCD and anxiety where there's kind of a crossover or usually two separate things altogether?
Well, they are two separate disorders. They are in two separate parts of the brain, but they do have a high comorbid relationship. And so you're much more likely to get OCD if you have anxiety. You're more likely to have anxiety if you have OCD. OCD in and of itself is very anxiety producing. A lot of people misunderstand this and they think that OCD is just intense anxiety. And I've even had parents tell me that, like, mental health professionals have told them that OCD is just more of an intense anxiety or a manifestation of anxiety. That's not accurate. That's not what the science shows in the brain. But it is very anxiety producing when you have to sit there for 3 hours waiting for the swoosh, you know, or you feel like everything is contaminated, or you feel like you're, you know, maybe not who you think you are. You think you're a bad person and you're having intrusive thoughts. I mean, that's obviously not a comfortable place to be.
Yeah. I've heard that too with people who talk about that story that they're telling themselves, and they're like, with OCD, I keep saying these negative things to myself. I'm not good enough. No one loves me. And then they just repeat it all over and over and over again. And that makes sense that the OCD could add to certain levels of anxiety, but they are two separate things, but there can be a crossover. Yeah, what do you see for parents? Kind of the same question that I had for OCD. What are some things that you can notice and pick up that your kid is being anxious? Obviously there's certain things that are universal, but is there any smaller things that you recommend to parents to keep an eye out for when it comes to recognizing if their kid's struggling with anxiety?
Yeah, we often think that anxiety is just someone's going to be shaking or curled up in a ball. And really, anxiety can manifest in so many ways. And for a lot of kids, especially boys, it can manifest as anger and opposition. And so I was actually just talking to somebody about this morning, you know, how it's all the same flavor underneath. So when you, not that every child that's angry is anxious, but it's an invitation to ask more questions of what is actually going on here instead of being reactive and being like, he's dysregulated. We need to deal with him. You know, it's what was driving that? Because a lot of times it's not flight, it's fight, you know? And so you're dealing with rage instead of running away.
Yeah. That's a tricky one. It really is. 'Cause it does show up different in just about every single person. I know I was feeling some anxiety the other day and I'm like, what's going on? And I knew I had a conversation coming up that I wasn't looking forward to. And so it was just kind of this weight that was weighing down on me, and it wasn't the end of the world. Everything was going to be okay. But I did recognize it and be like, okay, hey, take some deep breaths. Everything's going to be okay. But it was interesting to be like, ooh, nope, I see it. It's showing up and looking at it. Okay, nope, there's no reason. Everything, no one's dying. Everything's going to be okay in the end. But it kind of like you said with OCD, until you recognize and know that that's even a thing, you know, then you can't even do anything about it if you don't even know why you're feeling these ways or it's showing up how it is.
Yeah, same the interesting thing.
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, the interesting thing about that is the difference. So with anxiety, and I have my own anxiety disorder, so I totally get anxiety, is you can recognize it in yourself and you could be like, oh my gosh, like I'm feeling jittery and I'm feeling like I can feel the anxiety. And then you can reframe your cognitive distortions. You could be like, okay, I know like my body's having a false alarm. It's freaking out about this meeting. Let me bring it down a notch. Hey, nothing bad's going to happen. And I can talk myself off the ledge, or I can talk my child off the ledge. We can at least move the dialogue a little forward. When it's OCD, no rational thought will fix it. It's like, you can be like, I need to tap 3 times so my mom doesn't die. Intellectually, I know that makes no sense, but I should still do it just in case. And no one can talk you out of that. The only thing that can talk you out of it is the science of this is how OCD grows. You knock 3 times, OCD is going to bother you more about this. You have to resist the knock. And that's hard. And so that is, I think that's a little bit of a difference in anxiety and OCD.
Yeah. It's always something that's going to happen to mom, right? Like you step on a crack, it breaks your mom's back. I find the same way. Like I got to do two steps left in the lines and then two steps right and alternate it. And it's got to, like, that's the way that my brain just starts thinking. I'm like, what am I doing? And then it's again, all right, we're not going to have it be even. And I have to do something to like kind of break this thing because you get in this habit. And so the best thing you can do is not continue doing it is what I'm hearing. Is that correct?
Yeah, when you notice it, I mean, luckily yours doesn't seem like it's gotten to the point where it's like debilitating, but you know, symmetry OCD, the need to balance everything out. And there's not always a core fear around that. That is like, it just feels weird or feels uncomfortable to not do it. Yeah. Sometimes we add a little sprinkle of magical thinking, like something bad will happen, but sometimes it's just, it doesn't feel good. And for some people, it just, it dominates their world. They give into it and then now they have to, you know, they bump their left hand, they have to bump their right. You know, they break their left hand, they have to break their right. Like it can become really debilitating. Yeah. And so, yeah, breaking out of it seems like you intuitively recognize when these things are happening and dial it back, where it's like, maybe I'm going to mess up my steps on purpose and handle the discomfort that it's going to bring my body.
Hmm. Yeah. It's funny. Even while you were just talking there, I noticed I'm like the way my hands are. Like I have them intertwined and I like kind of do two and then I switch it and I do two the other way. So this might be a personal therapy session for me right now. I didn't realize this was going on.
Like, but he's got a lot of themes.
Yeah. Perfectionism is something that I've, you know, I'm a recovering perfectionist. And so I think it kind of correlates with that too. But, I was curious about the anxiety. And I think that's awesome that there are steps and things that you can do, where sometimes with OCD, it's a lot harder because it doesn't make any rational sense. What are some like the best practices that you recommend for parents or kids when it comes to dealing with their anxiety?
Yeah, anxiety, sometimes understanding that there's going to be what's happening in your body. You know, I think I'm kind of a science-based teacher where, like, understanding that there, and the way I speak about anxiety is so different than OCD, but anxiety, you have an overreactive lifeguard. This is how I at least explain it to kids. You know, you have a lifeguard, your amygdala, it's actually part of, you know, your brain. And it just wants to do a really good job. And it's like, oh, we should worry about that. We should worry about that. And it's just like, you've got a lifeguard that's not very great at its job. And so our job is to retrain the lifeguard. Or depending on your personality style, crush the lifeguard, you know, reboot, you know, 1.5 or 2.0, whatever analogy works best for the person who's hearing it. But, you know, when I respond to the lifeguard like it's a valid emergency, I'm teaching my body physiologically, actually, that was a valid concern. And so I'm going to get more of those alerts because I'm responding to them like, thank you for letting me know that meeting was going to be life-threatening. You know, every time I have a meeting, please just, you know, let me know that it's a life-threatening situation so I can worry about it every time. We train our brain. And so part of helping people with anxiety is to learn to retrain our brain. And so we can feel like we're having a false alarm. Physically, we can't do anything about it. I can't stop the heart, you know, pounding, the dry mouth, the shaky body. And I can say, you know, the emergency alarm bell has been rung. And it's going to take some time for that cortisol and adrenaline to run through my body. And so that's okay. Like, it doesn't feel good, but it's not a medical emergency. So that's number one, is reducing the fear of the fear. Because when we feel that stuff, I feel nauseous, I feel like I'm going to throw up, I feel like I'm having a heart attack, those things add to, then we keep hitting the emergency bell because we're like, we're having a physical emergency now. Let's just keep bringing it. Instead, normalizing that for kids, this is what it feels like when a false alarm is happening in your body. And it's going to take a little while for that to go away. But let's look at the fuel line. You know, what's fueling this? You're telling yourself that this meeting is going to be life-threatening, or you're telling yourself that you might throw up at school, or you're telling yourself that you can't handle this presentation. Is there another way to look at the story? And so I also like to work on the cognitive distortions that are fueling the anxiety and the emergency and the false alarm. What else can I tell myself in those moments? And those are the tools that really help.
Yeah. So reframing that story could be a powerful tool of what you're letting it mean to you.
Yeah, I think that's huge.
Well, that's kind of full circle from our very first thing of talk to yourself, don't listen to yourself.
Right.
And it seems, it's so cool that that happened. And it seems like a big piece of it is taking complete ownership for your life and recognizing, like, okay, one, I probably don't like having OCD or how it feels to be anxious. So what are the things that I can choose to do that are going to help me? It's not easy, but there are steps that I can take. And if you just sit back and let these things run their course, then you're not going to stand a chance. But if you go, hey, I'm one, like you said, aware of it. I'm aware of what these things are. I can tell myself the story. And then now what can I do to break these bad patterns and break these bad habits? Does it sound like I got it right there?
Yeah, exactly. Right. Because anxiety and OCD both want you to do something, and you don't have to be victim to its demands. You can take the reins and make those choices.
Yeah. What an empowering message. I love that. I love that. It's like, no, there is a solution. There is the things you can do. It's not, you know, the end of the world. This can be turned around. So I think that's so positive for so many people. Are there some things, like you said earlier, one of the things that parents do wrong sometimes is they give in to the OCD and play along with it. Are there other like common parenting mistakes that come up a lot for the people that you work with and talk to?
There are. I mean, I think as parents, we're trying the best that we can. And so we're sometimes following our gut, or we're just trying to put out fires. With anxiety, we can maybe avoid bumps before our kids even see the bump. You know, I'm going to protect my child from things that they're not even aware of because I know they can't handle it. Or I'm going to step in, I'll go with you to do this without giving them an opportunity to choose. You know, can maybe they would be willing to go and do that by themselves, or maybe they wanted to sign up for that class and I didn't even give them the opportunity because I'm trying to protect them. And so I feel like as a parent, you have to kind of let them walk towards that cliff sometimes and not always, you know, smooth the road for them. Because if they don't learn how to ride the bumps, I could be in the passenger seat and I can say, hey, there's a bump over there, or here's a little map, but I'm not going to grab the steering wheel because I'm robbing them of the experience to do it themselves. I think that's true with OCD as well. OCD is trickier just because you are literally the sink. And so you have to stop being the sink, and that's a beast of itself. But even with anxiety, I feel like we grab the wheel too often, and I understand why, but then we're not going to raise resilient kids.
Yeah. Easier said than done, for sure, because it's hard to see your kids struggle or suffer. And I always like to be like, it's the best of intentions. We know, like, your heart is in the right place. You want the best thing for your child, but the thing you're doing is actually hurting them more than it's helping them. And so you got to raise the bar and allow them to be able to go for it. And I found that kids are resilient, and kids do raise to the occasion so much more than you would expect. Did you see that as well?
Yeah. I think when we give them opportunities, it is just amazing. Even with my own kids, I'll think, oh my gosh, there's no way he's going to handle that. And it's not an issue. You know, I'm making an assumption that's not there, or they can handle it so much better than I thought they can. And even if they can't handle it, there's learning opportunities in the failure of, you know what, you at least went and you tried, and that was a brave move, and you're doing brave things. So there's always a great takeaway from anything, whether it's deemed a success or a failure.
Yeah. Is there anything on your heart that you want to share with our audience of parents? Is there anything that you've been thinking about, or that's coming up, or that stands out to you right now?
No, I mean, I thank you for giving me an opportunity to talk about OCD. I feel like OCD is so much more common than it gets airtime for. And I would just say, if anyone is listening to this and just like, oh my gosh, you know what? They're bringing up some things that I didn't realize were OCD, or Jesse's even talking about things that he does that I didn't realize I do that. That's OCD. Get an assessment. I think early intervention is key, and it's never too late. And even just a few sessions with an ERP therapist can make a huge difference. The ultimate goal is to give kids the tools to help themselves. And they can't do that if they don't have access to the tools. So that's the first step.
Yeah, I love it. Where's the best place people can go to check you out, to join the community that you have? Is it YouTube? Is it website? What's the best spot?
Yeah, you can find my podcast, my YouTube, and everything else at AT Parenting Survival.
Beautiful. Last question for you. If you were going to go back in time and you're having your first kid, kid number one is on the way, what would be the one piece of advice that you would give yourself?
Ooh, that is a tough one. I would probably say stop caring. Don't care about what other people are going to think. I was so immobilized. She had so many issues. And I was an infant and toddler mental health specialist when my first one was born. And I was going into other people's homes to help them with their toddlers who were dysregulated, had anxiety, all sorts of stuff. And my daughter was far worse. And I remember just being mortified. And I didn't want to go out in public. I didn't want to bump into anyone. And I would tell that younger Natasha, just calm down. It's okay. Just get her into early intervention.
You know what's so funny? That's something I hear from kids so much, especially when they're middle school, high school, is we just care so much about what other people think. And I talk to them and they were like, it's really heightened at this age. Like, you care so much. Is it, what are they going to think about my pimple or my hair or my shirt? But it doesn't go away. Like, adults struggle with this just as much. And that's why people dress the way they dress and drive the cars they drive and live where they live. It's so funny. Yeah. But it does seem like the people who are the most happy are the ones who are happy with themselves and care a lot less what other people think. So I'm right there with you. I think we all could do really well to care a little bit less about what those others think.
Absolutely.
Natasha, this was so fun. I appreciate you spreading the good word, and we'll make sure that everyone has the website there to check out and they can find you and join your community.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on.
Awesome. Bye, everybody.